Galatians chapter 3, verse 26 to chapter 4, verse 12. The 16th talk in a series on Galatians was presented by Jack Crabtree on November 3, 2019 at Reformation Fellowship.
The copyright for this recording is held by Jack Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to Jack Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Handout number 10, translation, installment 4, accompanies this talk.
Okay, moving right along in the book of Galatians, we go from the first section of his argument to the second section. And rather than review the first section, the first paragraph does that for us. So we're going to look at the first paragraph, paragraph 19 in part 10. This would be chapter 3, verses 26 through 29 in a normal Bible. I'm going to read the whole part. I hope to get through all of that today. So let me read it all. Now all of you are sons of God through your belief in Messiah Jesus. For as many of you as have been baptized into the Messiah have put on the Messiah. There is neither Jew nor Greek, neither slave nor free man, neither male nor female. Indeed, all of you are one and the same in Messiah Jesus. And if you belong to the Messiah, you are thereby the seed of Abraham, heirs in accord with the promise. Now I say, as long as the heir is a little child, although he is master over everything, he does not differ at all from a slave. Indeed, he is under caregivers and managers up to the age set by the father. So also with us, when we were little children under the elements of the Jewish religious system, we were in bondage. But when the fullness of the time came, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the covenant, in order that he might redeem those who were under the covenant, with the result that we received our placement as sons. And because you are sons, God sent forth the Spirit of his Son into your hearts. This shouts out that the Father is your Abba. As a result, you are no longer a slave, but a son, and if a son, then indeed an heir through an act of God. Now indeed, back then, because you did not know God, you were in bondage to what were not even gods by nature. But now, having come to know God, or rather having come to be known by God, how is it that you turn back again to the impotent and impoverished elements of religious observance, in which you desire to live in bondage all over again? You observe days and months and seasons and years. I fear for you that perhaps I have labored over you in vain. I beg of you, brothers, become as I, for I have become as you. Okay, this first paragraph, paragraph 19, it may very well be that it would be better to put it as the conclusion of the section ahead, but it just seems to me that what he's done is he's transitioning to a new idea. And he's transitioning to a new idea by kind of briefly recapping what the conclusion is of the last section. And that's going to be his point of departure for making the new idea. What's the new idea? The new idea is that we're free from the law. We're free from the Mosaic covenant. And we'll get into that as we go here. So he's looking back on the argument that he's given. God came to Abraham and made a bunch of promises. On what basis does someone qualify as a child of Abraham such that they're going to receive the same blessing that Abraham received? By believing in Jesus, the Messiah. From the very get-go, that was the line of descent from Abraham that God had in view. Those people who were children of Abraham, not by physical descent, but were children of Abraham by spiritual descent, if you will. They shared the same faith as Abraham. Well, that line of people are the people that God had always intended to bless with the blessing of Abraham. Okay, so that's what he argued, and then he told us what the purpose of the law was. If it wasn't to earn us the blessing of Abraham, what was the purpose of the law? He talked about that. So he's recapping all of that here in paragraph 19. Now, all of you are sons of God through your belief in Messiah Jesus. Well, what is a son of God? That's the first time he's mentioned that in Galatians. He hasn't used that phrase, I don't believe, up till now. All of you are sons of God. But notice how he ends the paragraph. And if you belong to the Messiah, you are thereby the seed of Abraham, heirs in accord with the promise. So I would argue that sons of God is simply another phrase to identify somebody as a child of Abraham, an heir of the blessing of Abraham. He uses all kinds of different descriptions to describe such a person. Sons of God is one of those. The emphasis here is all of you are sons of God through your belief in Messiah Jesus. So if you believe in Messiah Jesus, then you are, by virtue of the fact that you have belief in Messiah Jesus, you are a son of God. It doesn't matter if you're a Gentile or a Jew, or as we find out in a second, are slave or free, male or female, doesn't make any difference whatsoever. Every human individual who believes in Messiah Jesus is a son of God, which is to say, a child of Abraham, an heir of the promised blessing that was promised to Abraham. So all of you are sons of God through your belief in Messiah Jesus. For as many of you as have been baptized into the Messiah have put on the Messiah. Okay, baptized into the Messiah. He's just simply referring to the ritual of baptism, which at that time was a ceremony, an initiation rite that would celebrate your having made a personal existential decision to define your very existence by your relationship to Jesus the Messiah. You're going to be one of his followers. You're going to be his disciple. And when you have made that very important decision, in these early generations of Christians, they commemorated the fact, they signaled the fact that you had made that decision through this rite of baptism. I'm a Baptist, so I think baptism is dunking them in water, but if they sprayed them with a fire hose, so be it. I mean, whatever it was, they went through this ritual, this ceremony that signaled the fact that they had made that existential decision. Well, he defines what exactly is the significance of that decision or that choice. He says, as many of you as have been baptized into the Messiah have put on, or I think your typical translation has clothed yourself with the Messiah, with Christ. But I just use the idea of put on. That's a common metaphor in the prophets, I think, and it's not uncommon in the New Testament. Paul uses it a handful of times in his writings. To put something on is basically to want that thing to define you. The way we do when we put on clothes. How am I going to present myself to the world? The clothes that I wear involves a decision of how I'm going to present myself to you. What am I going to look like? What am I going to say about myself by the clothes that I wear? Well, to put on the Messiah is basically to define my identity by the Messiah. When you see me, you see a person whose very existence is given over to following learning from, obeying Jesus and having him as my master, as my Lord. So I have put on the Messiah if I've decided to so identify with him that my relationship with him literally defines my existence. Well, that's what baptism is, at least baptism, if it's really, truly, and authentically baptism, that's what baptism is signaling the fact that I have made that decision to relate myself, to so identify myself with Jesus in that way. I'm going to skip the parenthetical three for a second. He ends the paragraph then, and if you belong to the Messiah, you are thereby the seed of Abraham, heirs in accord with the promise. Okay? Well, clearly he's identifying being baptized into the Messiah as belonging to the Messiah. This wouldn't make any sense if he weren't equating those. So by being baptized into the Messiah, I then become a person who can be said to belong to the Messiah. It's literally in the Greek, you are of the Messiah, but I think the idea there is you're of the Messiah in the sense that you belong to him. And as we saw in the last section, to belong to the Messiah in that sense makes you the seed of Abraham. And what do we mean by the seed of Abraham? That set of descendants of Abraham to whom God promised that he would bless them with the very blessing that he had promised to Abraham himself. And that's why he ends it, heirs in accord with the promise. Okay, just on an aside there, I think it's striking and it's interesting that he doesn't say, it's my faith that makes me of the seed of Abraham. It's belonging to the Messiah that makes me of the seed of Abraham. Now, why is that significant? It's only significant because it's easy for Christians to misunderstand what Paul is saying and think that there's something magical about faith itself, that there's something virtuous about believing, that there's something virtuous about having come up with belief instead of unbelief for God, and that God is pleased with me for having come up with belief. What's pleasing to God is his Son, the Messiah. And when he advocates for me and he intercedes for me, that's where the magic happens. It's Jesus who gets mercy for me, not me and not my faith. My faith is significant simply because it's me deciding to define myself as someone who belongs to Jesus. And the promise we have is for everyone who belongs to Jesus, he will go to bat for me. He will advocate for me. He will intercede for me. So I know that I have mercy if I belong to the Messiah. But I think there's a lot of people in Christian culture who, if they were given the chance to kind of write this, they would throw all the emphasis onto belief and onto faith. But it's ultimately not faith that saves us. It's my relationship to Jesus. My faith is important simply because it's my faith that connects me to Jesus, puts me in him, in the Messiah, a member of his set of followers. Okay, right in the middle of this, Paul, I think parenthetically, it doesn't contribute to his argument. He doesn't do anything with it. He doesn't go anywhere with it. He just sort of kind of goes off on a tangent here. There is neither Jew nor Greek. Now, let me pause there. Obviously, that's significant because that's what the whole book of Galatians is all about. Do you have to be a Jew to be a bona fide follower of Jesus? So the fact that there's neither Jew nor Greek is very germane to the point of the book. But it's kind of like, having said that, he says, well, while we're at it, not only is there neither Jew nor Greek, but also there's neither male nor female, neither slave nor free. And that too is a distinction that is irrelevant when it comes to who is a son of God or not. All of us are sons of God, heirs according to the promise, regardless of what distinctions there might be in our creatureliness, in our social standing, in our economic status, and whatever. None of that makes any difference. If I believe in and therefore belong to Messiah Jesus, then I am every bit a son of God as anyone else who believes in and belongs to Messiah Jesus. Are there any social implications from what Paul is saying here? No, there aren't. Even though Bible student after Bible student, theologian after theologian, philosopher after philosopher will hang their hat on this verse and say, see, there's no distinction between male and female, slave and free, Jew and Greek. Paul says so. But we have to look at the context. There's only one sense in which there's no distinction between Jew and Greek, male and female, bond and free. And that is whether or not we stand to inherit fully the blessing of Abraham. That's what he has been talking about. That's what he's going to talk about. That's what this whole letter is completely and utterly preoccupied with. That's clearly the context in which we should understand that we are the same in Messiah Jesus. We are the same with respect to our inheritance. And what is that inheritance? Well, it's eternal life and a life in the eternal kingdom of God to come that is void of death and evil and oppression and injustice and futility and so on. That existence, that eternal, everlasting existence beyond evil and beyond death, that's the inheritance of every believer in Jesus, regardless of who they might be. But it's faulty to derive from this statement any other kinds of implications. For example, there's neither Jew nor Greek. That does not foreclose on the possibility that the Jewish people have a very privileged status in their future, in the future ahead of us, that God is going to do some special and amazing things with the Jewish people that he's not going to do with the Gentile people. Paul is not saying that distinction is invalid now that we are in Christ Jesus. Neither slave nor free. Paul is not saying that free men don't enjoy privileges in this life and have advantages in this life over slaves. What does Paul in Ephesians, Paul in Colossians, tell slaves that they should do? They should accept their position of subordination to their master. They should live in subordination to their master. Would it be better to be a master than a slave in this lifetime? Probably, depending upon the master, I suppose. But yeah, probably there are obvious advantages that at least are potentially there for the free man over the slave. Paul's not denying that. Paul's not denying for a second that, and nor is he saying, so if you're a Christian, don't you dare be a slave. You know, you kill that guy. You set things right. You get yourself free somehow because you have no business being a slave now that you are in Christ. Quite the contrary. He says, just accept it. That's where God has placed you. That's where God has put you. That's the position you find yourself in. God called you to himself when you were in that condition of servitude. So stay in that condition of servitude. Your relationship to Jesus does not require that you free yourself from it. Although you read the book of Philemon, And Paul is hinting very, 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 very strongly to the master there, Philemon. Philemon, you know, Onesimus is your brother. He is your brother in Christ. And it's not like you don't owe me your very life, Philemon. And I could sure use a companion. I mean, he's doing everything but commanding him to set him free. Obviously, when all is said and done, Paul's perspective is that there should never be any kind of class distinction of any sort whatsoever. All human beings are absolutely equal before God and before one another. But what would be his argument for that? Not that they're in Christ, which is what he says here, right? There is neither Jew nor Greek, neither slave nor free, neither male nor free. Indeed, all of you are one and the same in Messiah Jesus. But if you want to make a case against slavery, it's not because people who are Christians shouldn't be slaves. It's people who are people shouldn't be slaves. No human being should be a slave of another human being. Why? Because every human being, by virtue of their humanity, is created in the image of God. And that alone is sufficient to make slavery morally problematic. And I think Paul would make that argument if it were relevant. But to say that there's no distinction socially, politically, in their experience between slave and free, surely Paul's not saying that. Of course there's a distinction. And the same with male and female. This is the same Paul who talks about how the husband is the kephale of his wife in a marriage relationship. So in the context of marriage, the marriage relationship is a kind of hierarchical relationship created by God to be such, he says. He appeals to the Genesis account to defend that. So is there a difference between male and female? Well, certainly there's a difference between male and female. But the one difference that you cannot ever claim is that we have a different destiny, a different future, a different inheritance that awaits us. It's exactly the same, whether you're male or female, slave or free, Jew or Greek. Okay? I remember reading a book, I can't remember the title, but by a theologian from Fuller Seminary named Paul Jewett, way back in the 60s or 70s. And he landed on this one to defend a kind of position called evangelical feminism that was basically denying that the marriage relationship was in any sense hierarchical at all. And he proves that by pointing to Paul here saying there's neither male nor female. He acknowledges that this is Paul's better thinking rather than his worse thinking elsewhere, but this is his best thinking, and in his best thinking, he's saying that there's no distinction between male and female. But that's not what Paul is saying here. We have to look at it in its context and recognize the point that he's actually making within the context of this argument, and that has nothing to do with whether or not in a marriage relationship there's any kind of hierarchy. Notice that Paul doesn't spell out any social or political implications of this in here of any sort whatsoever, so we certainly can't use that to support saying that there's a social implication, because Paul doesn't. He doesn't do anything with it. And if we leave it in the context of Galatians, it's clear why he doesn't, because that's not what he means. I dare say there is some evangelical out there somewhere today arguing that gender is not binary. The Bible teaches that gender is not binary because Paul says there's neither male nor female. And if they haven't yet, it's only a matter of time. Because what we do is we take our current moral and social and political fads and we look to the Bible to find any kind of support we want for them. We're not interested in what the Bible actually teaches and what the Bible is actually saying. We're just trying to mine the Bible for support for what happens to be acceptable, agreeable, fashionable today. But that's been happening all along, and this is a key verse where you see that quite often. Okay, now in the next paragraph, Paul gets to the point of this section. Paragraph 20. Now I say, as long as the heir is a little child, although he is master over everything, he does not differ at all from a slave. Indeed, he is under caregivers and managers up to the age set by the father. So also with us, when we were little children, under the elements of the Jewish religious system, we were in bondage. But when the fullness of the time came, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the covenant, in order that he might redeem those who were under the covenant, with the result that we received our placement as sons. Okay, he's making a fairly easy and straightforward analogy here. The problem is, if you don't get rightly oriented to the exactly what analogy he's making, then you miss the point or distort the point completely. So we have to get oriented to what exactly he's doing with this analogy. In the ancient world, you had a man, a lord, a master over the house, and his household consisted of his wife and children, slaves, chickens, pigs, donkeys. That was the household. But the household included any servant, any slaves that he might have. Paul is saying, a little child, on the one hand, that little child is going to own all this stuff one day. I mean, he's in line to be the master of the house one day. So he has a very, very exalted status compared to anybody else in the household, on the one hand. On the other hand, as long as he's just a little child, his experience in the household isn't any different than a lowly slave in the household. And what do we mean by that? In what sense is that true? Well, what does the slave do? Whatever he's told to do. There's the master giving him instructions. The master might have managers, other slaves, but there are other slaves that he's appointed to manage the affairs of the house. And there are slaves that are put in charge of caring for the child. The caretakers and the managers of the household are going to tell the little child what to do and what not to do. And his whole life, his choices and his actions are governed by what they tell him to do. Same with the lowly slave. That's the experience of the slave. What does the slave do? His choices and actions are completely controlled by what the master or the master surrogates tell him to do. He just has to do what he's told. In that day and age, though, the father will have appointed a time, namely an age, at which that little child will no longer be treated as a child. And when he reaches the age of majority, whatever that the father decides that is, when he reaches the age of majority and becomes an adult son in the household, he no longer has caretakers and managers dictating to him what he will and will not do. He's an adult son now. He's expected to make up his own mind and make his own decisions and fit into the family and fit into the dynamics of the family as an adult, as a responsible adult. So, no longer under managers and caregivers. Slave never reaches that stage because he doesn't go from being a slave to being a son. Only a little child goes from being a little child to being an adult son in the household. Okay, that's the analogy that Paul is making He's saying the Jews are like that. The Mosaic Covenant, remember last week what he said about the Mosaic Covenant? It was a paedagogos, one of the caregivers, the slaves that was put in charge of caring for a child. The law, the covenant, was the paedagogos that led us to the Messiah. And before the Messiah came, we were under the paedagogos, but now that the Messiah has come, we are no longer under the paedagogos. He's making exactly that same analogy here. So as a Jew, before the coming of the Messiah, Paul says, it's like the Jews were like little children in the household. On the one hand, they had an incredible inheritance that awaited them, an incredible destiny that awaited them, an exalted status that they were destined to inherit. But as long as they were still little children, they were under the care and the governance of managers and caregivers, namely the Mosaic Covenant. The Torah acted like a caregiver and a manager over them. So what was their experience like? They had to do what they were told. They had to eat the way the covenant said to eat. They had to dress the way the covenant said to dress. They had to talk the way the covenant said to talk. They had to celebrate the way the covenant said to celebrate. And they need to rest the way the covenant said to rest. You just do as you're told, just like a child in a household. But like a child in the household, there was a date set when they would transition from being a child to an adult son. And what Paul is saying is that corresponds to the coming of the Messiah. When the Messiah came, he says, in the fullness of time, when all the time had elapsed that God in his purposes had set for the delay of the coming of the Messiah, when that time had passed, the Messiah came. And with the coming of the Messiah, now the Jews transition from being little children to being adult sons. Okay? Now, granted, you don't really become an adult son unless you believe that Jesus is the Messiah. I mean, that one who doesn't believe doesn't ever really get placed as a son, adopted as a son. But that's a finer point that isn't relevant to what Paul is saying here, because what Paul is saying here is you can't have belief in the Messiah until the Messiah is there to believe in. So the dividing point in history that is all important is the entering of the Messiah into history. When the Messiah entered into history, now people can believe in him, and by believing in him, they get adopted as sons, or placed as sons, literally in the Greek, placed as sons. Now, what does he mean by placed as sons? They transition from being a child to being now acknowledged and treated and looked at as an adult son rather than a little child. Okay, what does that transition look like? Before you're a son, you do what you're told by that which is your caregiver or your manager, namely the Mosaic Covenant. Whatever the Mosaic Covenant tells you to do, you do. When you become an adult son, that all changes. You're no longer under a caregiver and a manager. You are an adult son. You make up your mind on some other basis. You have other reasons for your actions. Now, Paul doesn't tell us here what that is. There's two answers that we can give to that that are completely compatible with what Paul is saying. One is, I take my cues from Jesus, not from the Mosaic Covenant. I do what my Master Jesus teaches me to do. Or the way he's going to put it later in Galatians, I do what the Spirit tells me to do, which I would argue ultimately comes to much the same thing. I mean, the Spirit is the better answer and the fuller answer and the more complete answer. God has sent his Spirit to sanctify me. He's going to call it the Spirit of his Son. God has sent his Spirit to sanctify me, and through the course of sanctification, I am learning to hear the instruction of the Spirit of God and obey it. And by obeying the instruction of the Spirit of God, that's now what controls and governs my life and my actions, not the Mosaic Covenant. There's a great deal of overlap, of course. Much of what the Spirit teaches me to do, the covenant was already teaching me to do. So there's a great deal of overlap. But for Paul's purposes in Galatians, it's not a complete overlap. The covenant tells me, keep the Sabbath. Spirit doesn't necessarily. The covenant tells me to eat kosher. The Spirit doesn't necessarily require that I eat kosher. It kind of depends on the circumstances I'm in. What else is at stake? What's loving to other people, for example? The Spirit's going to be much more interested in me acting in a way that's more loving to other people than that I meticulously and strictly obey the requirement of the law, of the covenant. So the point that he's making in this paragraph is, because Jesus has come into the world, the covenant is no longer that which controls and governs my life and choices and behavior. Something else does that, namely the Spirit of God. Okay, let's look at this sentence by sentence here, make sure I get everything. Now I say, as long as the heir is a little child. Now, this first sentence is not talking about Jews and Jesus. It's just talking about children and masters and slaves. He's setting up the analogy. Now, I say, as long as the heir of a household is a little child, although he is master over everything, he does not differ at all from a slave. And my contention is, in this respect, he doesn't. Namely, both of them have to do what they're told by the managers and caretakers in the household. In that regard, there's no difference between a slave and a child. Indeed, he is under caregivers and managers up to the age set by the father. Now he makes the analogy. So also with us. Now by us here, he means us, excuse me, us believing Jews. Us Jews who believe in Jesus, as opposed to you Gentiles. The next paragraph is going to be you Gentiles. This paragraph is us Jews. So also with us Jews who believe, when we were little children under the stoicheia tou kosmou in the Greek. Stoicheia tou kosmou. Now your typical English translation translates that under the elementary principles of the world, under the elementary principles of the cosmos, maybe. And then you have all kinds of wild speculation about what kind of Gnostic thought is perhaps behind this and everything. But boy, would that be a non sequitur. Who's been talking about the elementary principles of the cosmos here? And he certainly doesn't go on to talk about it, except one allusion back to that in the next paragraph. He doesn't do anything that anywhere else in Galatians. What is he talking about in Galatians? Do you have to keep the Sabbath or don't you? Do you have to eat kosher or don't you to be a bona fide disciple of Jesus if you're a Gentile? That's what he's been talking about. So it makes way more sense to take cosmos here, not to be the cosmos, not to be the world. A cosmos is any ordered system. Well, what are the elements of the ordered system? that is relevant here, the ordered system of the Jewish religion. What are the rituals? What are the festivals? What are the practices? What are the requirements of the covenant? All that fits into a structure that makes the Jewish religion that you're either practicing or you're not practicing. You're either observing it or you're not observing it. So the stoicheia to kosmou here are the elements of the Jewish religious system, I believe. So he says, when you were little children, under the elements of the Jewish religious system, see the parallel? You were under managers and caregivers. Indeed, he is under caregivers and managers up to the age set by the father. So also we, when we were under the caregivers and managers of the Jewish religious system, right, we were in bondage. Well, what's the bondage that he's talking about? It's important we don't read too much into that. He doesn't mean you were in bondage like you would be to heroin or to a drug. He doesn't mean, he's not talking about that kind of psycho-emotional experience. But what he is saying is you didn't have the option not to do the Jewish religion. Whatever the Jewish religion prescribed, that is what you did. You were in bondage to that. It was compulsory. It wasn't voluntary. When we were little children, when that was the only game in town, when that was the only way that anyone knew of gaining God's approval and being pleasing to God, is by doing his covenant. When that was the only game in town, we were little children under that system, and we had no option. We had no choice. It wasn't voluntary. It was compulsory. That's the bondage, I think, that he's talking about. But when the fullness of the time came, in God's purposes, God sent forth his Son. Son is another word for the Messiah, right? We've talked about that a number of times here. God sent forth his Son, his Messiah, born of a woman, born under the covenant, in order that he might redeem those who were under the covenant, with the result that we believing Jews, received our placement as sons. So with the coming of the Messiah, now there's a whole nother way of understanding our relationship to God. How do I find acceptance by God? How do I secure mercy from God now? It had been that I was looking to the Mosaic Covenant to do that, but now the Son has come. And if I understand the gospel message and what he did for me, dying on the cross, and what he's going to do for me, advocating and interceding on my behalf as my high priest, if I understand that, now I have another option for how I relate to God. I can just simply put on the Messiah. I can simply so identify with him that I belong to him and thereby become an heir of the promised blessing that God gave to Abraham. That's another option now available to me. And with that option, and that option is more secure, as we learned in the book of Hebrews, that I have confidence, I have certainty, I have surety now that I'm going to receive mercy. I could never gain that under the covenant. I was always plagued with the insecurity and fear. Have I done enough? Did I do it right? Is there more I need to do? Is God accepting my offerings, my sacrifices? I don't know where I stand. I couldn't really be confident. But we can be confident with Jesus. Because under the covenant, the question was, did I do it right? In Jesus, it's, is Jesus impressive to the Father? Because he's the one that's going to be advocating for me. Does the Father like the Son? And to the extent that I can know that the Father likes the Son, then I can be confident that that the Son will be listened to. And the Son has promised for everyone who belongs to him that he will appeal to God on our behalf. so we can know where we stand. So, the Mosaic Covenant, which had been the paedagogos that was taking care of us, was keeping us on track, was keeping us focused on the promises of God and the reality of God and the requirements of God and all that, without really giving me confidence of where I stood, but it was keeping me on track. Now, that is no longer necessary. Because now the Son has come into my life. And the Son is not only going to be my high priest and my advocate at the judgment in the time to come, but he's my rabbi now. He's my teacher. It's the Torah of Jesus that I listen to, not the Torah of Moses. Jesus instructs me. And if he's not here in person, he has prayed and God has sent his Spirit into my heart to teach me and guide me and lead me and instruct me. So the point Paul is making is, yeah, as Jews, we used to be under the Mosaic Covenant until the Messiah came. But then we were little children. But now that the Messiah has come, we received our, I think usually our translations have adoption as sons. I translated our placement as sons. That's a more literal rendering of the word. And it has nothing to do with adoption the way we think of adoption. So that to translate adoption can be kind of misleading. The point that he's making is, in the same household, the same person can be a son who's a little child one day and a son who's an adult son the next. And he's received his placement as a son in between. He's come of age. Okay. He says he's born of a woman. Not exactly sure why he stresses that here. I think the point, maybe some of you have some better ideas, but I think the point is that he's stressing his human personhood here. He's a human being. And it makes me go back to Romans chapter 5, where Paul is summarizing kind of the gospel. The man, Adam, is sort of represents and symbolizes for us the problem. And what was the solution to the problem that Adam represents? It wasn't the law. It was another man. It was the man, Jesus, and what he did and what he accomplished for us. That God's answer to my need for mercy from God is not to give me a law and ask me to perform. God's answer is another man to come in alongside and advocate for me. So it's not insignificant. The law is just an abstraction that calls me to a certain course of action. Jesus is a living, breathing, thinking person who can take initiative and act on his own and be my hero and save me. Well, that's what God gave us, is a son born of a woman, a person, to come inside and do for me what I cannot do for myself. So something like that, I think, is what he's trying to allude to. Born under the covenant. Jesus, probably a couple of things we could say about that. I won't remember them all, but born under the covenant, for one thing, he wasn't an outsider to this other way of life within Judaism. He grew up in it. He understood it. He understood it intimately. He's posing an alternative to finding the Kaiosune through the covenant. He's giving us an alternative, not because he's an enemy of Judaism, but because being an insider to Judaism, he understands intimately the inadequacy of it. It cannot accomplish for us what we really need. I think something like that is in view here. He was a human being, a Jew under the covenant, the son that God sent into the world, and he sent him into the world in order that he might redeem those who were under the covenant. Redemption, as you probably know, is simply to redeem a slave. The word comes out of the marketplace of slavery. That's where it's, I think, most at home. If you redeem a slave, you pay a price and buy their freedom. Having paid the appropriate redemption price, the slave gets to go free. What were we enslaved to that we need to be redeemed from? We were enslaved to a destiny of being condemned to destruction, and there's nothing we could do about it. We could not extricate ourselves. We could not free ourselves. We were just destined to be destroyed, and nothing was going to change that unless someone redeemed us, unless someone paid the price that buys us our freedom from our slavery to condemnation. So that, when the Bible talks about redemption, that's what it's talking about, I think. So the Son came and redeemed those who were under the covenant. Now, he doesn't mean that he didn't redeem those who are not under the covenant. Obviously, he did do that as well, but he's only talking about Jews in this paragraph. So those of us who are under the covenant, he redeemed us, because we could never be redeemed by the covenant itself. We could never gain the freedom from condemnation that we're looking to by the covenant itself. It was going to require something else. And it's the Son who supplied that something else that gives us freedom from destruction. Okay, moving right along. Now he shifts to the Gentiles in Galatia. And because you, not we now, but you, and because you are sons, God sent forth the Spirit of his Son into your hearts. This shouts out that the Father is your Abba. As a result, you are no longer a slave, but a son. And if a son, then indeed an heir through an act of God. Now, the bottom line of all this is he's wanting to say, not only did we Jews become sons, transitioning from little children under the law, we became adult sons through the work of Jesus, but you Gentiles are sons as well. And the significance of that is, and I think what he means by that here is, you're not little children. You too are free from the law or any other alien Torah. You're not obligated to some law of any kind. You are sons. And so you are in a position to have your life governed by Jesus just as the Jews do, or the Spirit of God just as the Jews do. Now he says, because you are sons, God sent forth the Spirit of his Son into your hearts. Okay, the Spirit of his Son, that's kind of ambiguous. What does he mean by that? He doesn't mean, as I think a lot of Christians might be inclined to take it, that Jesus is not only a human being, but he's also a spirit. And so how does Jesus come and live in my heart? Well, in the form of a spirit. The Spirit of Jesus comes and lives in my heart, and that's how Jesus lives in my heart. He doesn't mean the Spirit of Jesus in that sense. By the Spirit of the Son, he means the Spirit of God, the Holy Spirit. But he calls it the Spirit of his Son because, if you remember the Upper Room discourse in the Gospel of John, John tells the disciples, I have prayed to the Father that he send to you another parakletos like unto me, namely the Spirit of truth, whom the Father will send. And then at the end of that, he's praying to God in a prayer, thanking him that he's going to send the Spirit. So it's the Spirit of his Son in the sense that it's the Spirit promised by the Son, the Spirit asked for and requested by the Son. And that dips into the history of Jesus' interactions with his disciples. Because you are sons, God sent forth the Spirit of His Son into your hearts. Now, what does He mean by that? Well, God would not have sent His Spirit to sanctify you if you were not His Son. So the fact that you are experiencing the activity of the Spirit of God at work, He says, in your hearts, that is, in your insides, the fact that you are experiencing the work of the Spirit of God in your inner being is proof, is evidence that you are a son of God and stand to inherit the blessing of Abraham. Now, earlier in Galatians, remember, he talked about the Spirit coming and performing signs and miracles. And that's how that was what credentialed Paul's message as opposed to the false teacher's message. You know, when the Spirit came and performed miracles among you, was it while I was proclaiming the gospel that I proclaim or while they were teaching what they were teaching? I think it was when I was proclaiming the gospel that I was proclaiming. So God was credentialing my message as being authentic and true and from Him through the supernatural miracles that He performed. And he describes that as the Spirit coming. This is different here, because this is, He sent forth the Spirit of His Son into your hearts. That's not speaking in tongues and healing people and all that kind of outward stuff. He's talking about into your insides. So here He seems to be talking about the work of the Spirit of God sanctifying a person. There's a huge difference between belief that is merely some kind of intellectual assent and belief that comes about because God is messing with me on the inside. It's a huge difference. The Spirit in my heart is the thing that reaches into me and creates that impulse to want to belong to Jesus, to want to know Him, to want to follow Him, to want to identify with Him, come hell or high water. I mean, I don't care what the world thinks. I don't care how much I might look like a fool in the eyes of other people. This is just way too interesting and attractive to me to pass up on it. Why do any of us ever respond that way? Because the Spirit of God has begun to mess with me on the inside. He's tweaking me. He's changing me. He's I don't even know how to define it. But that He takes hold of my will. He takes hold of my chooser. And He orients my chooser in a positive direction toward God and His Son. And if that ain't happening, then we're not His sons. It's so easy to counterfeit it and fake it. You know, I've been surrounded my whole life in the university by people who will embrace Christianity out of incredible intellectual pretense. I mean, if you want to be intellectually pretentious, Christianity is a good gig because it's true and you've got truth on your side. And it's, you know, if you want to impress people, you've got other problems, but if you want to impress people with how coherent your worldview is and how deep it goes and how insightful it is and so on, yeah, be a Christian and believe the gospel and believe in Jesus and so on. But none of that makes you a son. It's just all BS. And I don't mean Bible study. It's just all intellectual posturing. And it is so absolutely important that we get beyond the intellectual posturing in our belief and have it be something that goes deep into what He calls the heart. It's only from the heart that this faith comes that saves us and qualifies us as a son. Well, He's saying, because that's happening in you, I know that you are sons as well. And as a result, you're no longer a slave, but a son. Okay, now, We could go a lot of different directions with this. You're no longer a slave, but a son. But we have a context here. What has he been doing with slave and son all throughout this whole section? A slave is somebody who does what he's told by whoever his caregiver and manager is. A son is someone who makes his decisions and governs his life on an entirely different basis. He's no longer having his nannies and the house steward tell him what to do and what not to do. Well, you Gentiles are in the same position. Now, why is that important? The false teachers are coming along to the Gentiles and wanting to make them little children again under the law. You need to be circumcised, and you need to eat kosher, and you need to keep the Sabbath, and you need to go through the cleansings. You need to live just like the Jews do. Paul says, we got freed from it, we Jews. And if you who are sons as Gentiles, you're free from it too. You don't need to be obligated to all that any more than I do as a Jew. And there was a reason why I kept the law at one point. But now that the Messiah has come, that reason is gone. I'm not obligated to it in the same way any longer. Then one more paragraph. Now indeed, back then, because you did not know God, you were in bondage to what were not even gods by nature. What he's talking about is you were polytheists and you believed in false god, idols, gods of all sorts. But they weren't really gods. You know, they didn't really control the universe. They didn't really create the universe. They weren't real gods, but you thought of them as gods. And you were in bondage to them. Well, what does he mean by in bondage to them? You did what you understood that they were telling you to do in order to please them. So your life was controlled and governed, your actions were controlled and governed by what you thought those gods were telling you to do. You didn't know the true God, so the only option available to you was the polytheism of the day, and your life was controlled by their dictates of those gods. But now, having come to know God, by having come to Messiah Jesus, they had to come to know the God who sent the Messiah into the world. So the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, a polytheist, a Gentile pagan polytheist, is coming to know God along with coming to know Jesus when he encounters the gospel. But now, having come to know God, or rather having come to be known by God, that is, all of us are victims of God's grace. We don't go looking for him and find him. He just takes us and makes us his own. We have been known by God. We don't know God. Now that you have come to know God, how is it that you turn back again to the impotent and impoverished elements of religious observance? Stoicheia, again, the same word that he used earlier. How is it that you turn back to the impotent and impoverished elements of religious observance? Paul recognizes whether it's in Judaism or in paganism, it really doesn't make any difference. You cannot attain the mercy of God through religion, even prescribed religion. God never intended the Mosaic Covenant to be able to get you the mercy of God. From before the foundation of the world, it was always the Son who was going to secure mercy from God for me. The Mosaic Covenant was that religion that established was playing a different role. But the role it was playing was not to be the basis upon which anyone would obtain mercy. Religion is impoverished and impotent. It's worthless. It's weak. It's nothing to God. So you don't get there by doing religion. This is one of the most damning comments about religion in Paul's writings, I think. So how is it that you turn back again to the impotent and impoverished elements of religious observance in which you desire to live in bondage all over again? You observe days and months and seasons and years. And I think he must be commenting on the fact that these Gentiles have begun to keep the Jewish festivals, the calendar of religious festivals. They apparently are beginning to practice those, observe those. You observe days and months and seasons and years. I fear for you that perhaps I have labored over you in vain. He's saying, the fact that you're doing this, all the time I spent, I taught you, I dialogued with you, I wept over you, all that I've done to in laboring to bring you to an understanding of the gospel, and you don't get it? You don't understand what Jesus has done for you and what he's accomplished for you and how irrelevant religion is now that you believe in Jesus? It was a waste of time. I'm afraid it might have been a waste of time when I watch what you're doing now. I beg you, brothers, become as I, for I have become as you. What he means by that is Jesus, or Paul, previously, when he was among them, he had become as a Gentile. He was living as a Gentile when he was among them. So these people who are now Gentile Jewish wannabes who are practicing the festivals of the Jewish calendar, he's saying, no, become as I. I'm living like a Gentile. You Gentiles should live like Gentiles because I became as you and I lived as a Gentile when I was among you. Imitate me. And as he's going to go on in the next paragraph to suggest, I lived that way because I was living in obedience to the truth. And that's why I felt the liberty to do that. Okay, almost out of time. A few minutes for a question.
Thank you. The word bondage is uh-huh. purely negative to me. Uh-huh. And law says that Paul says that the law is beautiful, wonderful, a gift from God so that we can know the truth. And yet he now refers to as impotent and impoverished. So I'm sort of having this I want to say, you're laying on a little thick there, Paul. This was commanded by God. This was literally a life or death involvement once they entered into the covenant. They could die under the law for failing the law. So it's not nothing.
Right.
I could see if it was translated, we were bound to the law rather than being in bondage to the law, it would be a lot, make more sense because that's like being married.
That's fine. I mean, that's just an issue of my
a prisoner.
Bad choice okay. of words in translating it.
But impotent.
Because that's his point, is that we are bound to it. That's okay. his point.
Because that's the only that was the only game in town.
Yeah.
Right. That's all God gave us. That's yeah. all we had, and we used to it.
Yeah.
Okay. But impotent and impoverished elements of religious observances.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me he's saying to do that in attempt to be saved. There's nothing in there that will do that for you.
That's right.
But he doesn't come out explicit. It just sort of sounds like he's bad mouthing the law. See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so, in which you desire to live bound or in bondage all over again. It seems to me, if they're pursuing the law, like the guy Jesus said, he went down to his house justified after having gone to the temple, the publican and the sinner. Okay, they went into the temple, they did the law, they come out with two totally different results. One thinks he's hot stuff, and the other one just throws himself on his face and goes, God, save me for doing the law. Now, if you do the law the right way, you end up on your face before God saying, God, save me. Be merciful. There's nothing impotent and impoverished about that to me. That's exactly where the law should lead you.
Well, like everything Paul is saying here, we have to understand what issue he's speaking to when he chooses his words. And the issue that he's speaking to is there anything in religion? Is there anything, because that's what he's talking about. He's not talking about the law. primarily. He's talking about the stoicheia,
the elements. In this last paragraph, in this last line, the elements of religious observance?
Yeah.
Okay.
Granted, that's informed by the law, so maybe I'm just quibbling with words, but what's impotent and impoverished is the religious piety that is required by the Mosaic Covenant. What's that going to get me? Is God going to be so pleased with me, he's going to overlook my perversity and evil and sinfulness as a creature and grant me mercy just because I am so pious? Is piety that valuable to God? No, it's not. And that's what he's getting at, is that piety does not have any power in it to recommend you to God. There's nothing there that gives it any power or any value to God.
And is he comparing that to the pagan religions they had?
Yeah, he's saying the same was true of their religions. Exactly.
It's just religion.
It's what?
It's just religion.
Exactly.
To back up a bit to the, I think it was your chapter 19, the end of chapter 3, your paragraph 19, the end of chapter 3. When you were talking about, I'm just thinking back and bigger to the sovereignty of God. Is it because we belong to him that we have faith rather than the other way around?
Right.
Yeah, so it's, again, going back to where he's talking to the Gentiles, the evidence that God is working in your life shows that you're sons.
Right.
I mean, it's the belonging to Jesus is what comes first. Belonging to Jesus is what comes first.
Right.
And then he works the faith in our lives.
Yeah.
Is that
exactly.
right?
Yeah. Yeah. The faith is just the outward mark, sign. I like to think of it as the brand of God's ownership on us. Is how do we know that we belong to God? We believe. Not intellectual BS, but from the heart, genuine, authentic belief from the inside. Yeah. Okay, I need to let you go. We'll review if necessary next week.